Hello and welcome to At the Movies with Mike and Marie, a show where two film professors talk about movies. I'm Marie Westhaver.
And I'm Mike Giuliano.
And today we're going to talk about Richard Pryor, comedian and actor. But starting from the beginning, talk about a beginning that is like something out of Dickens, Mike. And I know you know this background, but I didn't know this previously. His mother was a prostitute and abandoned him when he was 10. So he grew up in his grandmother's brothel. He was molested at age 6 by a teenage neighbor and later a neighborhood preacher. He was expelled from a Catholic grammar school in Peoria when the nuns found out that his grandmother owned a string of brothels. At age 16, he was expelled from a high school for punching a science teacher. So he said to escape this life, he was an avid movie fan and would regularly go to the movie theaters to just sort of block out the world and the things that were really happening and escape into the movies. Then he joined the Army, but even in the Army, he seemed to have had some violent incidents. Spent a lot of his time in the Army in an Army prison for an incident after a movie where a white soldier had seemed overly amused at the racially charged scenes in Imitation of Life. Pryor and several other Black soldiers beat and stabbed him, although not fatally. So, I mean, you know, when you think about starting off like that and you think, you know, how do you become a comedian with that kind of a background? And I almost think, how do you not? You know, there's a saying that, you know, show me someone who knows what's funny and I'll show you someone who knows what isn't, which is to mean that, you know, comedians hardly ever become comedians because their life is so hilarious. Usually it comes from a place of deep pain and a way to somehow find the humor in things that aren't funny at all. So, where do you want to start with Richard Pryor, Mike, because he's got such an interesting backstory? How far back do you want to talk about his beginnings, or do you just want to jump right into his comedy career?
Well, the one leads directly to the other. So to talk a bit more about his biographical background, just as he was really upfront about this on stage, it became comic material. In his autobiography, Pryor Convictions and Other Life Sentences, which is a wonderful title for a book, he is so blunt that it's almost frightening at times, because in a matter-of-fact way, he describes the family background that you've described so well. You know, it's one thing to grow up in a kind of grungy neighborhood where people have various roles in the underground economy. But in his case, his family ran the underground economy. His grandmother, as you noted, was the madam of a brothel, and his mother had worked as a prostitute, and other family members did all sorts of things. They ran a pool hall, a bar, a trucking company, which is actually is a legal enterprise to have a trucking company, but they did all sorts of things in the neighborhood. And everything you mentioned in terms of sexual abuse and just other misadventures, he had all that at a tender age. So not surprising that at age 14, he dropped out of school. Not surprising that even when he went into the Army to get away from all that, he gets into a knife fight and ends up, you know, in the brig and then being thrown out of the Army. Nothing's working out. So in his autobiography and in any number of interviews, and goodness knows on stage as well, he talked about how that kind of really rough upbringing directly became creative material. And let me give a brief quote from Richard Pryor himself about this. He says, "I lived among an assortment of relatives, neighbors, whores and winos, the people who inspired a lifetime of comedic material." So, you know, when you think about Richard Pryor in his prime, and that really essentially means as a stand-up comic doing what he does best, he draws so directly on that. And it's going to affect a life that was troubled all the way through. We're going to talk a lot about womanizing and drug addiction. And so our ratings will really spike, right? We're really going to have a lot of followers because it really is a shocking life in a lot of ways. And we'll certainly have the opportunity to double back on that. But let's look on that as the backdrop, because he does start to become a performer. If going back to when he was still in school or when he was, you know, meeting people in various places, he knew that he was a good storyteller. He knew he could get people to laugh. And he started drawing on his own life experiences there. But here's the fix he was in. He wanted to be an established stand-up comedian, and he was successful at doing that in the early 1960s. He was living in Greenwich Village for a while. His hero was Lenny Bruce, because Lenny Bruce could use words, or certainly used words that you weren't supposed to use on stage, definitely R-rated language, and was really blunt in talking about his own life experiences and politics and you name it. But it was the language, wasn't it? At that time, it was shocking to hear. You could, because other comedians could talk about risque situations. They could use innuendo. but not to use the four-letter words. Some of the words have more than four letters even, but just really, really disturbing material. Now, interestingly enough, when he lived in Greenwich Village, he saw Lenny Bruce on the street once, but never actually met him, never saw him perform live. He knew Lenny Bruce primarily through the comedy albums. And a lot of Americans first got to know Richard Pryor. You know, there was television and nightclub work and this and that, but the comedy albums really sold well when they came out. So he, ironically, got to know Lenny Bruce's work that way. Now, the tension was, as Richard Pryor was starting out as a stand-up, again, he was very successful by the early to mid-60s, very, very successful, initially on the black comedy circuit, what was sometimes called the black comedy circuit or the black and tan comedy circuit. What's black and tan? This is a phrase we don't use nowadays, just as well we don't. But what it meant was there were some comedy clubs that were an almost entirely black audience. So you get known on that circuit in the same way that musicians would be known on a circuit, but would not have quote unquote crossed over, not or quote unquote mainstream, which is a loaded word, but essentially where you're on the black comedy circuit. The black and tan clubs were clubs that had both a black and a white clientele. And so in some ways you're starting to quote unquote cross over, if you will. But his fix was this: he could do extremely well on the black or the black and tan comedy club circuit nationwide. But the problem was, if you want to go the next step, how do you get there? Las Vegas was the big paycheck. He could do Vegas, but he had to keep the material clean. He was getting TV gigs. He was on the Johnny Carson show, the Tonight Show with Carson, Merv Griffin, Ed Sullivan. Goodness knows you had to be clean with your language on Ed Sullivan, right? He did all those shows. I mean, I first saw him on shows like that. You know, mid-60s, he pops up on a TV variety show or a TV talk show. But the problem was he was simultaneously still appearing on the black and black and tan comedy circuit, where it could be a little more open. The youth you talk about, that troubled youth and the kind of comedy it leads to, is definitely R-rated. And he speaks very bluntly about it. So you can't do that on the Ed Sullivan show. And so, you know, he had like kind of split life there. And it was sort of driving him nuts, actually, that he couldn't be totally blunt the way he wanted to be. And so an example of how he was a big hit on the black comedy or black and tan comedy circuit, Red Fox was an extremely influential older comedian and who eventually did break through to a wider, meaning whiter audience. But Red Fox spent decades on the black comedy club circuit. Red Fox ran a nightclub in Los Angeles. There, Richard Pryor could do anything he wanted, and he knew what his métier was there, right? But then, like almost like the next night, you're at some club where you got to clean up the language, or you're doing, you know, the Tonight Show with Carson, and you can't say that on the air. So he really had a lot of inner tension and turmoil. And the most famous anecdote in that respect was 1967. He's doing a Las Vegas club gig, paid extremely well. But in his mind, he's thinking, I can't do this anymore. I mean, I'm really good at it, but it's just, you know, it's not the real me. He walked out in the middle of the gig. I mean, not like between performances, but the middle of a performance. He's like halfway through his act and he says, I can't do this. And he walks away. It was a big national story because you just don't do that, right? And it hurt him for a little bit, but that's how far I want to take our discussion at the moment, that he's getting established, but he reaches the point where he's got to make a break one way or the other. Play it safe, go the Bill Cosby route, if you will, take sometimes troubling material, but you know, clean it up a bit, soft pedal it a bit, or go the other route where you're so uncensored, you're so open, that some people will laugh and some people will just simply be appalled. And among those being appalled, they're not going to book you. You won't get on the show. You won't get the club gig and so on.
I'm glad you mentioned Bill Cosby because I think he was a standard bearer of a sort of comedy that really was not very confrontational, where Richard Pryor, you know, they refer to him as the Black Lenny Bruce. They also say this, that he uses foul language that has been compared to raw sewage mixed with social insight and has been compared to Mark Twain. Now, I don't know if I see Mark Twain, but he certainly thought that comedy was the way to go because he said comedy rules, don't let anybody tell you otherwise, and there are no rules in stand-up comedy, which I really like. You can do anything you want and you can say anything that comes to mind just as long as it's funny. If you ain't funny, then get the F off the stage. It's that simple. So I did want to make sure I mentioned before I forget, that he's the one responsible for the 5-second delay that they have on Saturday Night Live, that in order to book him, they knew, based on that quote I just gave you, that he didn't always have everything scripted. He didn't necessarily get up and do the same routine every single night. He improvised. He read the room. He, you know, riffed on things. And so they knew if they just put him up there and gave him a microphone, he was likely to say something, you know, really upsetting. So we can credit him with that 5-second delay.
I wanted to quickly mention Mark Twain. I was going to mention Mark Twain later, because very late in Richard Pryor's career, when the Kennedy Center in Washington established its annual Mark Twain Prize, a Lifetime Achievement Award for comedians, the very first recipient was Richard Pryor. At that point, he was already ill with multiple sclerosis and so on, and they knew that, you know, now was the time to give it. So there is a Mark Twain connection very directly in a biographical sense. The second thing I'll mention very quickly is, as he does become better known, Saturday Night Live does have a lot to do with that. When that show goes on the air in 1975, the producer, Lorne Michaels, has Richard Pryor as one of the early guest hosts. And some of those skits are really funny, but they're also a powder keg, because he did like to improvise. He was dangerous that way, hence the 5-second delay. One of the fun, if you watch the early, well, I teach a course on cultural history of television, and we watch the first season, part of the first season of SNL, and there are various skits in the first couple seasons that are really funny, but Richard Pryor has one, which is a parody, a satire of The Exorcist. And so, you know, The Exorcist had just come out like a couple years before, right? So it's on everyone's mind. And he's so funny because he plays the priest, okay? And Lorraine Newman plays the demon child. And speaking of a potty mouth, the demon child, you know, from the movie, like she really sputters and, you know, says all sorts of awful things you're never supposed to say out loud or even think. And the demon child in this skit starts to make fun of the priest's mother. It becomes like a mother joke, right? And talk about a big mistake. You don't diss someone's mother like that. And the priest is gonna, you know, have a volcanic explosion when the demon child starts to go after the mother. But let's talk about that phase, Marie, like in the early to mid 70s, because a lot is starting to percolate for him there in terms of stand-up and also in terms of television and movies. You know, since I'm pontificating just in that period, he is one of several screenwriters for Mel Brooks' Blazing Saddles, which has a lot of charged racial subject matter. I use the film in one of my courses, and students generally find it very funny. Some are unhinged and disturbed, quite correctly, actually, by the racism in it and how to take it, how to respond to it. Well, that material was written by Richard Pryor, who's a Black sheriff character played by Cleavon Little, which originally Richard Pryor was supposed to play, and Mel Brooks was for that. But, you know, he's the director of the film, Mel Brooks, but he doesn't control everything. The producers were nervous. They thought, you know, Richard Pryor, you know, this is a powder keg. And even though you don't have to worry about a 5-second delay while shooting a film like that, you still got to worry about him. So they thought a safer bet in casting would be, you know, Cleavon Little. He's also doing a lot of other writing for television. He wins an Emmy Award for writing a Lily Tomlin special. Two of them work together really well. So this is a phase when he's really, you know, starting to break through. Now, my awareness of him actually goes back to those television talk shows and, you know, and comedy albums and things from earlier in the career. Well, the comedy albums are more from like early 70s on, but by the late 60s, where he's starting to do some film work, starting to do some albums, you know, he's sort of, you know, like a toe in the pool kind of thing. He's starting to do that stuff. So I knew him at that point, but I know him. I mean, I knew him as a performer. But for me, the moment when it really registered was when Dinah Ross starred in Lady Sings the Blues in 1972. He plays the piano man in that, and it's really a dramatic role. And he is really good. And the reason I mention that right now is only at a few points in his career did he play straight dramatic roles. I mean, there's some comedy always in his work, but straight dramatic roles. And for me, it was, I don't want to call it a missed opportunity, but one that was not fully developed. I mean, we know him as a great stand-up comedian who did some good work as a film actor, but goodness sakes, he could have been a really, really first-rate dramatic actor if he kept with it. Instead, it's more sporadic. So in Lady Sings the Blues, which I saw first run back in 72, I thought, yeah, I know Richard Pryor, and now I really know him. You know, like I really appreciate him at that point. The other dramatic role, which comes later in the 70s, I think like around 78 or so, would be Paul Schrader's Blue Collar. He has a co-starring role with with Yaphet Kotto, who just passed away, and Harvey Keitel and others in that film. But you see him in a film like that, and you realize what talent he had that wasn't always fully developed or always fully utilized. And for various reasons, including some of the personal demons we've talked about, he didn't always have the career trajectory or evolution that one might have hoped for there. But watch him in Lady Sings the Blues or Blue Collar, and you think, what a good actor he was. So we're at this point, Maria, I'm going to hand it back to you, but we're at this point, like early to mid 70s, where it really all starts to come together for him on various media platforms, as they would say. stand-up comedy in a club, writing for television, being a guest host on Saturday Night Live on television, working in the movies, both as a writer and an occasional actor and so on. It's starting to click at this point.
You know, in terms of Blazing Saddles, one of the reasons they couldn't use him is because he couldn't be insured. You know, so he sort of tanked his own career by being so controversial in that respect. I'm glad you brought up how good he is in dramatic roles, because I agree with you. It really does seem like a missed opportunity, except for the fact that I think it's hard for audiences who want you to be funny all the time to accept you as a dramatic actor. And I'm thinking about Robin Williams, how manic he was when he was on stage doing his stand-up. And then when he would make movies, you know, he made lots and lots of funny movies. But when he tried to branch out and be serious, people didn't like him as much. They didn't want him to be serious, even though, you know, he did a pretty decent job at the Bicentennial Man and, you know, some of the other things where he tried to stretch himself, you know, in terms of his talent and what he could do. I want to mention, though, all the comedians who claimed that Richard Pryor was an influence, because they're some of my favorites. They're probably yours, too. Starting with George Carlin, Martin Lawrence, Dave Chappelle, Chris Rock, Sam Kinison, Louis C.K., Jerry Seinfeld, Jon Stewart, and Eddie Murphy, and especially Eddie Murphy. I want to mention that, you know, whenever we're going to do one of our shows, I go back to try to fill in all the gaps of, you know, what I never saw from that person. But I had seen Richard Pryor stand up, but I wanted to refresh my memory and watch those shows again. They're still just as hilarious. But while I'm watching it with my husband, he says, you know, God, he really reminds me of Eddie Murphy. And I thought, no, actually, Eddie Murphy should remind you of Richard Pryor. It's watching it out of order that gives you that feeling. But what was so on point about that, it was right down to the outfit he had on. He had on a red suit. And, you know, I just keep thinking of that show Eddie Murphy did where he wore the red leather suit. So even the look, the timing, even the kinds of jokes, very much in that Richard Pryor vein. And what's even more interesting is that Richard Pryor was considered for some of Eddie Murphy's roles, 48 Hours, Trading Places, Beverly Hills Cop, which I think Richard Pryor would have been fantastic in. But it's interesting that once Eddie Murphy hit the scene, he kind of ate his lunch.
Well, Marie, here's what happens. Because Richard Pryor's personal life was so troubled, with drug addiction and womanizing and the list goes on, and time actually spent in jail for various things. Imagine if you're a movie producer or an agent or anyone in the business end, right? And you got to hire somebody. You might well find yourself saying that Richard Pryor, for various reasons, has peaked. You know, he had some great success. He had great hits and this and that, but he's too hot to handle now. He's too unpredictable. As you said earlier, he's uninsurable. That's a big deal. When you're making a movie, you have to have your actors insured. And there are all sorts of stories about why, for various reasons, in terms of, you know, health issues or psychological issues or whatever, why some actors have trouble getting the insurance. And that will stop it right in the tracks there, dead in the tracks. You're not going to be hired for a project if you can't be insured. And so, as you alluded to earlier, he's just too dangerous at that point, a powder keg, as I keep saying. Meantime, here's Eddie Murphy, very much following in his wake. You're absolutely right. Even the wardrobe, sort of like what I call, you know, pimp wear, if you will. You know, like, and when we're talking about like a red suit, I mean redder than all those theater seats behind you. Mm-hmm. I mean, like shockingly red. Like going down a street at night, you know, you wouldn't need a street light on. You'd see the red jacket. But anyway, the fact that Eddie Murphy's considerably younger and he's working in basically the same mode of performance and material. So Marie, you know, think about it. If you're a producer, director, agent, et cetera, who are you going to hire at that point? So think about the, you know, 48 Hours, Trading Places, things like that. I think the smart money at that point, frankly, was on hiring Eddie Murphy, who did, you know, those are trademark roles for him. So not to diss him at all. But I essentially agree with you that from a creative standpoint, those would have been great second acts, if you will, for Richard Pryor, having gotten through the early phase or half of his career, however you want to put it. Boy, if he'd gotten those roles, he would have still been top box office. And maybe that would have helped settle him down in other ways. It's speculation, but he wouldn't have been quite on the skids as he was later on. But, you know, but then what would have Eddie Murphy done? So it depends on how you want to approach the equation.
I also think that those movies are better written. They're just better scripts, because a lot of the comedies that he would go on to make, several of them with Gene Wilder, they're funny, but they're silly in a way.
Yeah, they are.
And I wanted to mention, first of all, Which Way Is Up from 1977, which is about an orange picker who inadvertently becomes a union leader and is forced out of town, leaving behind his sexually obsessed father and spouse. And in this, he plays three different roles, which, of course, while I'm watching, I'm thinking, you know, this makes me think of Tyler Perry. And I wonder if Tyler Perry was, you know, in any way informed by that idea. Like, you know, that's funny to have, you know, the same guy playing three completely different roles. That's a great setup. And then, of course, Stir Crazy in 1980, which was directed by Sidney Poitier, which is about two guys who go to prison for crimes that they didn't commit, but no prison cell can keep them locked in. And this is one of those goofy movies with Richard Pryor and Gene Wilder, who improvised many of their scenes together. Before we get to Jojo Dancer in 1986, Mike, what do you want to say about the earlier films?
Well, there's a lot to say about the earlier films in the sense that there's not much to say about them. I mean, those are films that I saw first run and oftentimes was reviewing. And honestly, my feeling was as I'm watching a film like Silver Streak from 1976 with Gene Wilder, as I'm watching it, there are some really funny gags. It's entertaining. I didn't feel like I'd wasted my time or anything. But you know what? It's disposable. It's like you watch those films and enjoy them. Well, I always use the expression well enough. Somebody said, did you like that? Yeah, Richard Pryor comedy. Well, I liked it well enough. It was okay. Richard Pryor himself was even more harsh in assessing films like that. In his autobiography, he talks about Silver Streak, some of the other Gene Wilder films. He says, you know, they really were commercial. They were meant to be that. He didn't always like the roles particularly. He just kind of went through them. He made a lot of money, or he actually calls it monies. He made the monies, as he likes to say. He made the money, and he just, and what I got to say, if you look at that period, late 70s, very early 80s, he's at his commercial peak. He has films like Bingo Long, Traveling All-Stars, and Motor King, Silver Streak, Grease Lightning, Which Way Is Up, Stir Crazy, as you mentioned. There's several others. He's making as many as three films a year at that time. He's really on a roll. Now, that's the commercial stuff. And again, you know, he gets middling reviews on it, but the box office is huge for a few of those films. He's one of the top stars at that point. What I want to do at this point is it takes us into the late 70s, and he had done a lot of stand-up already and you know, I'd done some other concert films and would do additional concert films. But for me, the absolute career peak, and this is why we should talk about it before Jojo Dancer, the absolute peak of his career creatively is 1979, his live concert film. It's one of the most, I'm searching for words here because it's actually one of the most effective concert films I've ever seen. By concert here, I mean a stand-up comedian just doing his gig, right? And the cameras, you know, you don't look on it for like great camera work or editing or anything. Just plant the camera in the right place. Let the guy tell his jokes, right? If you're going to watch nothing else by Richard Pryor, watch his concert film from 1979. Now, I had the experience, and this flavors my response to this day, not just seeing it first run, but this was back when downtown Baltimore still had movie theaters along the Howard Street corridor. And I would go to see, I mean, I went to see all the blaxploitation films, so-called blaxploitation. I saw this, you know, first-run Hollywood films, whatever. The audience response was vociferous. It was boisterous. You went for the audience as much as for the film, right? And I could do a whole show just talking about that, the stuff that was said in the audience, right? Or what was going on off the screen. But the reason I mention this, with the Richard Pryor live in concert film from 1979, I saw it with a packed audience, really crowded. And as he was telling his jokes, the feedback from the audience was hilarious. The kind of give and take, I really felt like I was at a live concert. I mean, it was just, as he told the jokes. And the thing is, he mined that early unhappy family experience that you described at our outset. He turned all that into comic material. It was hilarious. I mean, stuff that really otherwise described is not at all funny, right? When your grandmother runs a whorehouse, come on, let's be blunt here. But the jokes he told that were so funny. And the jokes he told about race, again, think back to Blazing Saddles. People still get unnerved by it because the racism, what do you do it? What do you make of it? How's it intended? He wants to get a rise out of people, and he does. So when you watch it, you know, Blazing Saddles, he wrote a lot of that racial material. A lot of people think somehow it must have been like a quote unquote racist Mel Brooks or something. No, that was Richard Pryor who wrote that, not Mel Brooks. And he discusses that in his autobiography. He wrote that stuff. But anyway, in his concert material, he hits the racial theme. White America and Black America, he hits it so hard and so consistently and so devastatingly that, yeah, you're laughing, but a lot of it's really nervous laughter because he's saying out loud the stuff we're not supposed to say. And he's using words that, you know, my mama taught me I should never use and certainly not in public, right? And he's right out there with it. So Marie, this is one reason why, to double back on your point, why is Eddie Murphy getting some of those roles by, you know, late in the 70s, more into the 80s, that Eddie Murphy by the 80s gets his role. Richard Pryor is like too hot to handle. And this has nothing at the moment to do with his personal demons, just simply on stage. Boy, if you're a club owner or you have a TV show or you're casting a movie, you got to ask yourself, do you really want to hire him? And what's going to come with that, or what might come with it? It's a nervous proposition.
Well, we know that, you know, he was a volatile person. He was also married 7 times. But, you know, where are you going to get, you know, good role models of relationships when you grow up in a whorehouse? You really have to cut the guy some slack. He said he did Superman 3 and the toy just for money. But his most personal piece, I think, is 1986's JoJo Dancer. Now, he's admitted that the fire that nearly killed him while freebasing cocaine in the early 80s was, in fact, a suicide attempt. His management created the quote-unquote accident lie for the press in hopes of protecting him. So in JoJo Dancer, they start off with that episode, and then he is in the hospital. He has sort of an out-of-body experience and goes back, you know, over his life to the people and things that had happened to him. So it's basically his autobiography, paralleling many incidents and experiences in his life. He said, though, that despite obvious links to his own experience, the film was not completely autobiographical, that he gave JoJo some of the emotional content of his life, maybe more than he meant to, but it isn't, you know, a word for word story of his life that you might think, given that it's mostly or somewhat autobiographical, but he pulls no punches when he shows the dark sides of his life. So we are starting to run out of time here. I did want to mention one other person that I noticed something very Richard Pryor, and that is Steve Harvey and that mustache. He's got, you know, that sort of Richard Pryor mustache. So that actually, we're out of time for this episode. So I just want to encourage everybody to look for our other podcasts on dragondigitalradio.podbean.com. And we will see you at the movies.
See you then.
Connect with us. We are Dragon Digital Radio.